Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Not only do we have the standard two guests today, both have the same initials. Pure coincidence, I assure you. First, Muin Rabbani will discuss Israeli politics, the war on Gaza, and Trump's curious Middle Eastern tour. And then Meron Rappaport will talk about Israel's strategy of destruction in Gaza, how and why. Israel's war in Gaza has entered a new phase, which looks to be characterized by total destruction. As if what's been going on for the previous 19 months wasn't destructive enough. It was obvious to anyone watching this horrendous spectacle, anyone that is not propagandized into unconsciousness, that Israel's aim was the destruction of Gaza as a society by destroying its physical infrastructure. Not just basic stuff like water treatment plants, but the physical bases of civilization, like schools and hospitals. But it looks like Israel is going further, to turning every building in the Strip to rubble. The other day, the head of the leading opposition party, Yair Golan of the Democrats, a former general and deputy chief of staff, so no innocent, said Israel is on the way to becoming a pariah state, like South Africa was, if we don't return to acting like a sane country. A sane country does not fight against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not give itself the aim of expelling populations. He was roundly denounced for this, but the comment looks quite on target to me. Here were some observations on Israeli politics, on the international reaction of the sort that Golan was fearing, and on Trump's ridiculous tour of the Middle East as Muin Rabbani. Few people can match Muin's knowledge of the Middle East, the sharpness of his analysis, and the fluency of his delivery. He has served in several diplomatic roles over the years and is co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that covers the region where he also hosts its Connections podcast. Muin Rabbani. The old, always quotable Smotrich had a brutal quote the other day where he talked about completely destroying Gaza. We are disassembling Gaza and leaving it as piles of rubble with total destruction with no precedent globally, and the world isn't stopping us. That's all true, isn't it?
That's very much true, and he's not only saying it, but his government is also doing it. There was, for example, a recent article in Plus 972 magazine, which explains very clearly that the Israeli military is working to systematically reduce what remains of the Gaza Strip to rubble, and that most of the destruction currently is taking place not as a result of bombardment, but as a result of military engineers placing explosives in buildings and other structures and leveling them to the ground. And Smotrich and his colleagues have also been very clear about what the objective of this campaign is, which is to ensure that Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, if and when this genocidal military campaign comes to an end, have nothing to return to, and will be left with no option other than to leave, to permanently leave the Gaza Strip.
Smotrich has an interesting role ideologically. He's often described as an extremist, but he's really hard to distinguish in policy terms or rhetoric from the rest of the political establishment, starting with Netanyahu. What do you make of these alleged distinctions in the Israeli political spectrum?
Well, I would make the point that the entire Israeli political spectrum has shifted consistently to the right. As, for example, Norman Finkelstein has pointed out, the chief distinction within Israel now is not between the center and the right or the left and the right, but it's between the far right and the extreme right.
That's a pretty subtle distinction.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at the Likud, which, you know, despite its ideological extremism, used to make efforts to pass as a center-right party. Now, I mean, it would be violating their moral code to make the same kinds of statements and intentions that it used to 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, it's inconceivable to me, for example, that the current Likud would be capable of either relinquishing control over the Sinai Peninsula or engaging in negotiations about returning the Golan Heights to Syria, or even signing something as meaningless, if you will, as the Y River Accord, which Netanyahu signed in the late 1990s during his first term in office, during the Clinton years. The entire political spectrum has shifted to the right. Its center of gravity is now very far to the right. And I would argue that the main distinction between Smotrich and also his comrade in arms, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and others like Netanyahu, but increasingly less as time moves on, is that, you know, they are willing to state in public, in exceptionally crude and vulgar terms, exactly what Israel is doing, what they think Israel should be doing, and what Israel hopes to achieve. And that, in turn, forms part of the background of these recent statements and moves we've seen, for example, from the British government, from the European Union, and so on. I mean, we can have an argument about the extent to which these measures are or are not meaningful, but ultimately, I think the problem for these governments is that Smotrich left them with no choice. He spoke too plainly about what these governments have been supporting for a year and a half.
Now, the other day, Yair Golan, who is the head of the Democrats Party, which is what passes for some sort of liberal Zionist opposition in Israel, said, "A sane country does not fight against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not give itself the aim of expelling populations." To which Netanyahu said that was a blood libel. I mean, what do you make of that interaction?
Well, it's interesting because Yair Golan has a history of exceptionally racist statements himself. And like you said, he passes for the center-left opposition in Israel. And he demonstrates, again, how far the entire political spectrum has shifted to the right. He's a former general himself. And when he talks about Israel killing babies as a hobby, he knows what he's talking about because he speaks from experience. He's been in charge of quite a few brutal Israeli military campaigns himself. But this particular statement needs to be seen in the context of political rivalries within Israel and fears among certain elements of the Israeli political elite that the government's policies are transforming Israel into a pariah state and making its relationships with its closest allies and sponsors more difficult, and that these policies are going to result in a diplomatic backlash. And the other element, of course, is that there's this ongoing debate within Israeli ruling circles about whether the genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip should continue in order to achieve the objectives we've just discussed, or whether alternatively it should be paused or even halted altogether so that Israel can retrieve its captives from the Gaza Strip through an agreement with Hamas. So it's kind of a different sectors have different priorities. And of course, it comes to the accusation, which I don't agree with, or at least not entirely, that Netanyahu's primary motivation for everything that Israel is doing is simply to remain in power and to avoid the court cases that he's confronting about corruption and all the rest of it.
Yeah, there does seem to be a rising tide of international complaint now. We see Canada, France, Britain making noises about Israel going too far. I even saw a report in the Washington Post the other day that Trump is losing patience with Israel, whatever that means. What do you make of this international response?
Well, there has definitely been a change in tone. So if you want to look at it in terms of how people are saying things or even what they're saying, I think you can make an argument that a Rubicon has been crossed. And it has certainly set off alarm bells in Israel for good reason, because Israel has been able not only to act with total impunity now for decades, and particularly during the last 18 months, but, you know, you look at the statement of, for example, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States in an interview he gave reviewing the Biden administration. And he stated explicitly, you know, that we didn't think that Biden would support us as unconditionally as he did. We thought that at some point Washington would call us to a halt, and that never happened. And so all of a sudden, for Israel to be confronted with these statements, and additionally with Trump now taking initiatives with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Houthis in Yemen, even with Hamas, without any regard for Israel. In other words, the United States is no longer coordinating its Middle East policies with Israel, and it's certainly no longer prioritizing Israel's agenda and interests in its Middle East policy, but it's now acting bilaterally. And if Israel wants to come along, all well and good. And if it doesn't, then the U.S. will proceed anyway. So that, I think, is a real and genuine concern for the Israelis. As I said, I think, you know, it's in that context that the alarm bells are going off. And I think a particular concern for Israel about, for example, the recent moves by the British government and the European Union probably have less to do with what the UK and the EU actually did. And I think more a fear that, as in the past, before taking these measures, that London and Brussels consulted with Washington and may even have gotten a green light or been encouraged by Washington to proceed. But if you look at the substance of what they actually did, the UK has been an important supplier of weaponry to Israel. It has been taking overflights for purposes of intelligence collection in the Gaza Strip consistently since October 2023 and so on. And what it has now done, rather than depriving Israel of anything that it has been receiving from Britain, rather than imposing any sanctions on Israel, it has suspended further discussions on a UK-Israel free trade agreement that does not yet exist. In other words, rather than taking away anything from Israel that it has been providing, it has refused to give Israel something that Israel does not yet have. Some people may consider that a significant sanction. I personally don't. And I think even more shameful and embarrassing is the European Union, because the European Union in 2000 signed what's known as an association agreement with Israel. This gives Israel preferential trade privileges with the European Union. It allows Israel to participate in all kinds of EU research and other programs, almost as a member.
It's like an honorary European country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's I think, a pretty good way to put it. But Article 2 of the Association Agreement makes very clear that respect for human rights by Israel is a fundamental condition of its access to this association agreement. And that was put in at the time because of widespread opposition among European public opinion to simply moving ahead with this agreement. Now, since 2000, when the association agreement came into force, until today, the European Union apparently has been unable to determine whether or not Israel is respecting its human rights commitments under this agreement. And what has it done now, more than a year and a half into a live-streamed genocide? Rather than suspending the association agreement or taking any measures against Israel, for example, the bare minimum would be to ban illegal products from illegal settlements produced in the context of an illegal occupation, Brussels has decided to begin a review of Israel's human rights commitments in accordance with the association agreement.
Well, that seems like a task of about 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you know, this being the EU, it'll probably take several months, if not several years. In other words, the EU, in the midst of this live stream genocide, which has now been going on for over a year and a half, is unable to make a determination about whether or not Israel is violating Palestinian human rights. I mean, I think it's a charade that doesn't even fool those who concocted it.
I'm speaking with the journalist Muin Rabbani. What do you make of the role of Steve Witkoff in American diplomacy these days?
Witkoff is a very interesting aspect of all of this. I mean, there are several aspects to him. He's been assigned this file by Trump, in addition to the Ukraine file and various others, which is why I refer to Witkoff rather than Marco Rubio as a U.S. Secretary of State. And there are different factors influencing his approach. On the one hand, he has quite clearly prioritized the release of Israeli and dual national captives in the Gaza Strip over any other objective regarding what's currently going on. But he's also, I think, as I think anyone in his shoes would be, committed to succeeding. He doesn't want to fail. And apparently he feels a strong personal commitment to ensuring that these captives are released. But I think he's also intelligent enough to understand that the only way he can succeed is through an agreement rather than through supporting a continuation, let alone an intensification of Israel's genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. And what happened is in January, even before Trump assumed office, he, of course, forced Israel to accept this proposal that it had been rejecting for the previous year. Hamas accepted it as well. Hamas had already accepted it. And then in late February, he double-crossed Hamas by introducing a different agreement than the one that the parties had already agreed to and that was already being implemented. And that laid the basis and provided the justification, if you will, for Israel to intensify its siege in early March to unprecedented levels, and then to resume in full force its military campaign in mid-March. And he's now engaged in discussions, that are being mediated by the Qataris and the Egyptians to try to put a new agreement into force. Now, the obvious observation, I think, is that if he was serious, if the U.S. was serious, it really would take no more than a phone call to ensure that an agreement is once again reached and implemented. We know that because that's essentially what happened in January. Why has he not been doing this? I think there are all kinds of explanations. The one that I don't accept is that the Trump administration is somehow a handmaiden of Israel. I think the more likely scenario is that under Trump, the United States has undertaken a number of initiatives in the Middle East, which it views as highly significant for U.S. interests. And here I'm thinking, for example, of the recent agreement that Trump signed in Saudi Arabia and Qatar in the UAE. Of course, the U.S. and Iran are now engaged in direct negotiations against vociferous Israeli opposition, and of course the opposition of hawks within the Trump administration as well, and all these other initiatives. But Gaza is not a fundamental U.S. interest. The only time it will become important to the Trump administration is if there are costs associated with supporting Israel in terms of its other relationships in the region. And I think basically we can look at and is a U.S. license to Israel to continue what it's doing in Gaza as kind of a compensation for Israel being shut out of all these other initiatives in Syria and Yemen and so on that Washington has taken this year.
Okay, yeah, let's talk a bit about other relationships in the region. Trump's tour of the Middle East was quite something, collecting pledges for money. God knows how real they
are. Yeah, money that doesn't exist.
Yeah, buddying up to some awful monarchs, he said of MBS. I like him too much, whatever he means by that.
It was almost homoerotic.
I know. Oh, what I do for the crown prince, he also said. And then meeting the president of Syria, calling him young, attractive, tough guy. What's all this mean? Is Trump just susceptible to flattery and promises of fake money, or is there something more going on?
I think it's both. I mean, on the one hand, as we know from years of experience and observation, Trump is all about the headlines. To him, being able to announce that he has pledges for $1 trillion in investments in the U.S. is more important than actually $1 trillion of investment in the U.S. And I mean, I'm not an economist, you are, but I suspect you will be severely challenged finding a single one of your colleagues who thinks that all these pledges that Trump has been touting since his trip to the Middle East are actually going to be fulfilled in the manner that they have been pledged.
They sure know how to play him, though.
Yeah, well, you know, there's also, I think, now a feeling to an even greater extent than years past that U.S. foreign policy is basically for sale to the highest bidder. We certainly saw that with the election campaign when Miriam Adelson, Sheldon Adelson's widow, pledged $100 million to Trump. And, you know, all of a sudden everyone was saying, well, this will ensure that Trump will let Israel have its way, will attack Iran, will allow Israel to annex the West Bank and so on. And these states that Trump visited have priorities of their own. And they came to the conclusion, quite rightly, in my opinion, that if you pledge enough dollars, you will get your way in terms of policy priorities with Washington. That's how the U.S. political system works. And now they're learning how to play the game effectively. And, you know, to the extent that there are contradictions between their policies and Israel's policy, as there are, for example, with respect to Syria and Iran, they can easily outbid Israel. I mean, what?
Yeah, I was going to say, Israel cannot win a bidding war with Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
No, I mean, in Saudi Arabia, Trump signed what is called the largest military sale in history. Contrast that to Israel, which has received over $20 billion in free weapons during the past year and a half. So what can Israel offer? At most, beginning to pay for their weapons, you know, but is Israel in a position to purchase even a third of what Saudi Arabia has pledged to purchase? Of course not.
Yeah, it's funny. Trump, you know, views normal trading relationships as somehow taking advantage of the United States, but he doesn't seem to see Israel in the same light. Is he going to change his mind eventually?
That, I think, is a very interesting question. Quite clearly, exempting Israel from all the rhetoric and measures taken against others, I think a primary concern here is keeping his coalition together, because while Trump is often described as a non-interventionist and isolationist and so on, and that is a growing element of his constituency after the Democrats gleefully accepted the mantle of the war party. At the same time, the natural home of the neocons and the hawks is also the Republican Party, and there's quite a few of them in his administration. And so I think, you know, giving Israel a pass is a combination of Trump following his instincts and also keeping key constituencies within his administration happy. And again, seen from Washington's perspective, a confrontation with Israel doesn't make sense unless there is more to gain from it than there is to lose. And I don't think we've reached that point. At the same time, Israel has to be careful, because the Republican Party has become a personality cult. And so the Israel lobby in Washington can't exercise influence over the Republican Party the way it traditionally did, or the way it still does with the Democratic Party, because its senators and representatives in the House are going to be much more fearful of being primaried by the leader of the personality cult than they're going to be fearful of AIPAC.
There is, of course, the Christian Zionist constituency within the Republican Party to worry about. They wouldn't be happy to distance the U.S. from Israel.
No, but that's one of the core constituencies that is also in the Trump coalition. But having said that, I think we also need to recognize, particularly in the context of a personality cult, that many of these hawks and neocons and Christian Zionists and so on are also opportunists of the first order. You know, yes, they have their principles, but they're quite happy to change them if that's what's required to remain in Trump's good graces. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that a U.S. ambassador to Israel and very prominent Christian Zionist Mike Huckabee has suddenly become an anti-Zionist, but he's made statements, you know, I think it was something along the lines of the U.S. doesn't need permission from Israel to negotiate with the Yemenis, which would have been inconceivable for Mike Huckabee to make a year ago. He would have been denouncing, if another U.S. government had done this, he would have been denouncing Washington for not continuing its campaign against Yemen and for not coordinating its negotiations with Israel. So never underestimate the opportunism of officials and politicians, which I think carries at least as much weight as their proclaimed principles. Moving forward, there's quite clearly a shift taking place in U.S.-Israeli relations. Again, you know, we've seen this with respect to Iran, Yemen, even the talks that the U.S. conducted first directly and then indirectly with Hamas, and of course, lifting the sanctions on Syria, or at least announcing an intention to lift those sanctions while Israel was agitating for their continuation. And what's happening here is that U.S. has identified priorities, agendas, and interests, and it's no longer willing to wait for Israel to come on board to pursue that agenda. Another very good example is Saudi Arabia. These agreements that were recently reached between the United States and Saudi Arabia, whether you think, you know, they're going to see the light of day or not, had, since the waning days of the first Trump administration, been made dependent on Saudi-Israeli normalization. In other words, Saudi Arabia would only be able to access these agreements with the U.S. if it first normalized relations with Israel. Well, under the second Trump administration, Washington has now come to the conclusion that Israel is unwilling or incapable of making the changes in its policies towards the Palestinians that would be required for Saudi-Israeli normalization. So what has it done? Has it massively increased the pressure on Saudi Arabia to accept less from Israel? No, it simply ignored Israel and went ahead and signed these agreements. So those are significant shifts in U.S. Middle East policy. Where we haven't seen a significant shift, and I think it's very difficult to speculate about whether or not we will moving forward, is a shift in U.S. policy towards Israel with respect to the Palestinians. Again, because it's not considered a priority by Washington. It's not a significant regional issue as far as Washington is concerned. So it will let Israel continue to have its way.
Now, finally, with Gaza on the way to be completely flattened, there's going to be a population of 2 million people with nowhere to go. Is there any viability to this, what they call in Israel, the Trump plan?
Not in terms of it being implemented as proposed by Trump. And let's be clear, it's not a plan. It wasn't a plan. It's a proposal. It's an initiative. Anything else. Well,
he's very good at those.
Yes, exactly. And there have been persistent reports that the United States and Israel, perhaps in coordination with each other, have reached out to a number of governments in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East to take in large numbers of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. And they've been met with categorical rejection. And the key Arab states that would be involved, Egypt and Jordan, view the implementation of this initiative as a direct threat to their national security. You may recall that after Jordan's King Abdullah was given the Trump treatment at the Oval Office in front of the world's media, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah Sisi immediately canceled his own visit to the White House, which he had been very much looking forward to. I think the real impact of the Trump proposal is that it provides license to what Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip. That could create a situation in which you begin to see Palestinians seeking to leave the Gaza Strip by hook or by crook simply in order to survive as human beings. That, I think, is a much more likely scenario than kind of an orderly mass expulsion of 1.5 to 2 million Palestinians across the Middle East and Africa and who knows where else.
That was Moeen Rabbani, who is, among other things, co-editor of Jadalia, an Ezine on Middle Eastern Affairs. My name is Doug Henward. The program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of Leonard Bernstein's Symphony No. 3, The Kaddish, performed by the New York Philharmonic, led by the composer. Next, an investigation of how Israel has been destroying Gaza. 972 Magazine, named after the telephone calling code for Israel-Palestine, is, in its own words, an independent online nonprofit magazine run by a group of Palestinian and Israeli journalists, providing in-depth reporting, analysis, and opinions from the ground. A week ago, the magazine, in collaboration with another outlet, Local Call, published an article written by Meron Rappaport and Oren Ziv on Israel's strategy of destruction. We've all heard reports and seen evidence of the transformation of much of the landscape of Gaza to rubble and assumed it was the result of aerial bombardment. In fact, as Rappaport and Ziv show, it's been far more the result of soldiers on the ground blowing buildings up and knocking them over with bulldozers. The point, rendering Gaza uninhabitable. Here with more is one of the authors, Meron Rappaport. Israel has now flattened Rafah, and it appears to be moving onward to the rest of Gaza. Is Smotrich right that the aim is now total destruction?
Smotrich is a minister, a very influential minister in the government. It does seem that many of the government decisions were basically initiated by him. The return to the war was almost a condition. When the ceasefire on January was pronounced, he agreed to remain in the government only on the condition that the war will restart, and it did restart. At the same time, of course, he is not the prime minister and he's not the chief of staff. So yes, certainly this is the main direction, let's say, where Israel is going. This is also according to the army orders, although they are not as explicit as Smotrich put them. This is where the army is going. Yesterday, for example, the chief of staff, Eyal Zamir, said that we cleaned the Rafah. That's how he described what happened in Rafah. So we understand what the word clean means in his vocabulary. We cleaned Rafah and we will clean other areas. So yes, I think this is the way things are going. Netanyahu also said that we are destroying building after building so that you will have nowhere to return to. So certainly the atmosphere, even though maybe it's not the official order of the army.
In your article, you and your colleagues spoke with soldiers who described the wholesale destruction of neighborhoods and now a whole city. It's not just aerial bombardment. That's not just fighter planes dropping bombs that are doing it. So how do they go about this systematic destruction of whole neighborhoods and cities?
This is the main finding in our the investigation that Oren Ziv and I did for Local Call 972. The fact that most of Gaza cities are destroyed is not new. It has been verified by various satellite images and, of course, testimonies from the ground. What I think we have pointed out is that most of it, and we cannot give numbers because it's very, very difficult to identify, but it does seem that the majority of those destroyed buildings were destroyed in a premeditated way, not connected to battle, by a decision by army commanders on the field that this is the routine work of the army, going out and destroying whole neighborhoods. And as we have seen in the last 2 months, the whole city of Rafah, 200,000 people before the war, now completely flattened with only 4% of its building are really standing intact. This is a premeditated, this is really the modus operandi of the army, is just destruction as a goal per se. And this is, I think, unprecedented since World War II, I think, such a scale of premeditated, not connected directly to combat. This is, I think, quite unique, not in a positive way.
Yeah, I want to emphasize the distinction. This is not something, you know, there's somebody in that building, let's knock it down. It's because they're deliberately choosing to destroy everything. It's not like some military decision, but something broader than that.
You can always say that this is military in the sense that for the military, of course, if there are no buildings, then there's no threat. if the whole of Jabalia is completely wiped out, then Jabalia is no longer a threat. So you can say that this is a military objective, but is a very monstrous military objective. And of course, the army is playing it naive, depicting it as an operational issue, when for everyone, from Netanyahu to Israel Katz, the Minister of Defense, to Smotrich, Minister of Finance, and to the soldiers that we have talked to, and to soldiers that post videos on social medias, it is clear that the aim is that the Palestinian will have no place to return to. Although the army insists that these are all a part of operational needs, it is quite clear that the political background behind this mass destruction.
There's an interesting detail in your article that the orders to perform all these destructive acts, they're not coming from the very high level. They come from a battalion commander. Are the senior political and military officials trying to maintain some kind of deniability?
As far as we understand, there was no official order coming down from the chief of staff or even from the commander of the Southern Command to go in this destruction campaign. And that these decisions were made at the level of battalion, brigade commanders. Nevertheless, it is quite clear, and we have sources confirming that, that it has been brought, of course, to the attention of the chief of staff. And the chief of staff did nothing. So it is very much complicit. And the fact that Rafah has been destroyed so systematically in the last 2 months, to say that the chief of staff was not aware of that or was not aware that this is not done out of operational needs, but in order just to flatten a city, this is to escape from responsibility. You have to understand now that the Israeli army is very much aware of the ICC, the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We have seen this court issuing arrest warrants for Netanyahu and ex-Minister of Defense Gallant, but it is not impossible, and there has been many signs, indication that this court will issue warrants for the arrest of army commanders and generals. They want to distance themselves. An example is that till, I would say, the end of 24, battalion commanders and brigade commanders were interviewed to Israeli media openly in their name. Now it is not allowed even for a brigade commander to be interviewed. Only his first name could be given, not his face, although everyone knows who they are, because from their function, people know who is the commander of a certain brigade. So it's not a real secret. But in the Israeli media, you don't see their names anymore or their faces. It's very clear that they are, while saying that they act according to international law, the IDF, it is very much aware that these actions may be brought to the ICC and may be a basis for indictment against these officers, these commanders, or even regular soldiers who post videos showing themselves destroying houses.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're not shy about posting videos of them blowing things up and knocking them over with bulldozers. Do they just feel they can do this with impunity? Nothing's going to happen to them?
They know, for example, there is this now famous Avraham Zarbib, a rabbi, who boasted really with the bulldozer that he is the flattener of Jabalia. And he continues now to show videos from Rafah. He, for example, said in one of the interviews with him that he knows that he will not travel to Europe. He's a settler, he lives in a settlement, he works in Tel Aviv as a rabbi, so he is aware that he will not travel to Europe. He knows, of course, that he will not be investigated, let alone indicted in Israeli courts. This will not happen. As for higher level, I think they are aware, and I think this is why they, at least the less ideologically committed commanders, really prefer to take a distance.
Now, you talked to a bunch of these soldiers who are doing this dirty work. What kind of feelings did they display? Did they feel guilty, proud, conflicted? What was the feeling you got off them?
The soldiers that we have talked to, and we have talked to about 10 soldiers, some of them very low level, really soldiers, plain soldiers, some of them commanders, some of them even higher commanders. They feel bad about what they have done, at least unease, but I would say even worse than that, and not only unease, but really, really bad about what they did. Of course, the soldiers that we have seen in the videos are quite proud. Most of them are ideologically motivated, settlers or really professed right-wingers. But from what we have heard from the soldiers, the majority of the soldiers just don't care. They see it as part of their routine. For many months, there has been very little fighting, in real direct fighting. Yes, there were ambushes here and there, but there's no regular fighting. So their routine was either to sit in some kind of a bunker or bases, or to go out and blow up houses. So that's the routine. So people are completely used to it. Of course, you have to add to it the revenge. There is this general feeling that leveling Gaza to the ground is not a bad thing, that the idea that they, as I told you before, if there's no Jabalia, then there's no threat. This is the impression, of course, within the survey, but the impression is that there's mainly indifference, and that they accept it as a fait accompli, as something that you just have to do.
I'm speaking with the journalist Maren Rappaport. Clearly the point of this is to make the place uninhabitable, that people displaced have no place to return to. Now we're talking about 2 million some people. Where do they go? What happens to them in the longer term? Has anybody got a plan for that?
The plan has been put out quite clearly, not by the army itself, although the army itself said that one of the targets is to move, concentrate population. This is how it is phrased in the army command. For Netanyahu and Smotrich, it is quite clear. You will concentrate them in very small areas, mainly in the southern part of Gaza, yeah. Probably around what used to be Rafah, in huge tent cities, confined, concentrated there, not to say concentration camps, and that somehow food will be distributed there by American contractors. But the aim is that once they will, 2 million will be concentrated in this very, very dense areas, of course, without any job, without any facilities, schools, universities, nothing. People will prefer to take the offer and leave, emigrate. It's a forceful emigration.
Leave for where? Go where? I mean, nobody particularly wants them.
That's one of the biggest lacunas, of course, here. Even Netanyahu, while saying that we will push them and then try to implement the Trump's plan, although Trump himself did not repeat it, but this is a code name in Israel when they say implement the Trump plan, meaning the forceful evacuation of Palestinians. Even a few days ago when he mentioned it, he said that the only thing, we have problems with third countries that will host them. This is, of course, a huge issue. It is unlikely that neighboring countries like Egypt or Jordan will accept them. They would be happy maybe to take refuge in Europe, but Europe would, with the right wing rising, it seems not very likely that they can accept more than, you know, a very symbolic number, some tens of thousands at the most, not 2 million people or even 1 million people. So yes, of course, this is a huge problem. And it's not clear whether the Palestinian, despite the hardship, despite the bombing, despite and everything, will really agree to move to this kind of concentration camp, knowing that there is no future there, that this is not a temporary shelter till they can go back home, because they will see that there's no home, that the houses are being destroyed. So they will have to flee, and then we'll be told to go to some kind of a camp in practically the desert. Southern Gaza is quite desert-like, to the desert without any hope of coming back to their cities. So why should they go there? So can Israel transfer 1 million people? How do you do it? Do you start just shooting at them so they will flee? We are seeing already the rise of international attention and pressure, threats by Britain, France, Canada, 17 members of the EU threatening sanctions against Israel. The Trump administration seems also changing a little bit his position. So is that possible under these circumstances to force 2 million people to go in this voluntarily into these camps? I'm not sure.
That increasing foreign disapproval you just mentioned, does that have any effect on either Israeli public opinion or the decisions of the senior political leadership?
It does seem so. It certainly has an impact on Israeli public opinion. We have seen just yesterday Yair Golan, the head of the Democrats, now the largest, let's say, Zionist left Jewish party, going out very strongly about the crimes that Israel is doing, and warning that Israel will be completely isolated. I see it even in more mainstream media, these reports about the atrocities in Gaza. They don't report about the atrocities in Gaza, but they say, look what the world is seeing in Gaza, as if saying, this is what the West is seeing in Gaza. Not this is what is going on in Gaza, if you see the difference.
Yeah, well, it's like a psychological defense mechanism, distancing.
Yes, but the effect is quite similar. There is still very substantial majority, not less than 70%, who support a deal to release all the hostages in return for end of the war. Even on the operation itself, I've seen a poll just yesterday. That's 44% for the operation, 41% against. This is also quite unusual, because when Israel goes for a military operation, usually the support for military operation is huge, is above the 75% usually. So the fact that it is below 50% that support a military operation, that the army is saying that it is vital, et cetera, in order to liquidate Hamas, that the support is very low. Yes, I think it is affecting Israeli public opinion. I think that Israelis are losing also confidence in the army, not only in Netanyahu. In Netanyahu, again, I would say the same numbers, about 70% lost any confidence in Netanyahu, and are saying that Netanyahu is continuing the war only for political reasons. The army itself, that was always seen not a part of the political discussion, was above it, the political discussion, mainly for the people who now are opposing the government but still go to the army. So for them, the army was above political discussion. Now I think the army itself is losing confidence. So I think, yes, there is here, certainly has an effect. We predicted, myself and others predicted, that this is the end so many times during this 19 months. So I don't want to fall in this trap again and say that we are nearing the end. But it does seem that Israel opened too many fronts. Yes, against Hamas, but the front with the Houthis is open. The Ben Gurion airport is almost closed. Most airlines companies are not coming. Front now with Europe, front with the American administration, front, of course, with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and even the Emirates, and against its own people, against the majority of the Israelis who don't want the war to go on. So I think this government opened too many fronts. It may have crossed a line that will force it to at least freeze its operations, if not end it.
But regardless of that, in the near future, it looks like the destruction will go on?
Unfortunately, yes. Unfortunately, I think it's not very clear, but if really they will now take Khan Yunis, there are orders to evacuate Khan Yunis, and most of the people have left. If the Israeli army will go into Khan Yunis, I think there is a great chance that Khan Yunis, which is, I think, the city least hurt for the moment, relatively, of course, it was also damaged, but to a lesser extent, will the process that Rafah went through and Jabalia went through will manifest itself in Khan Yunis and maybe Deir el-Balah. That's another city that was the least damaged, even less than Khan Yunis. So if the Israeli army will go into these two cities and start this destruction campaign that it has done in Rafah, it is quite likely that this is the plan, unfortunately.
That was Meron Rappaport, a writer for 972 magazine, a joint Israeli-Palestinian project, and co-author of a piece on how Israel has been systematically blowing up and bulldozing buildings in the Gaza Strip, turning it all to rubble. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Agnus Dei from Haydn's Mass in Time of War. Again, Leonard Bernstein in the New York Philharmonic. Till next week, bye.